All right. I actually was looking at our syllabus, and we're really not that far behind. I thought we were like a week behind, but we're actually like only like a day and a half or something. So we're doing well. But we are right now. We just finished the calling of Peter, and we finished last week talking about the healing of Peter's mother-in-law with the fever. I argued that it made sense on both of those accounts because right after Jesus' temptation, he goes and to the sea, enlists his army, sea being a symbol for chaos. And then he goes and after Peter leaves his family, some people may have assumed it was a shaming thing or a curse called down on his family because of the way in which he left, abandoned his family from the fishing business, and that's why his mother-in-law may have been sick. Nevertheless, Jesus healing her both validated Peter's movement as well as Jesus' own identity. But I want to kind of lay the terrain of what we're going to be moving through throughout today. We might get to this today, if not throughout the rest of this, the next couple days, of what's happening, of what I think structurally Mark is doing here. Remember, one of the things I told you on your exegetical papers that I want you to be able to answer is, if this was taken out, what would be missing from the Gospel of Mark? Or why did he organize it in this particular way? Your outlines, really quick, on Mark. I've had several different emails from people that were doing them, and I've emailed them back, but I want to be very clear. If you are halfway through the book and you're only eight, and you're already hitting the eight-page mark on your outline, you're going too detailed. And I appreciate your diligence and your thoroughness, but the assignment's not intended to overwhelm you. The assignment's intended for you to become familiar with the way in which the Gospel of Mark's fitting together. So, by all means, be detailed, be whatever. But if it's 40 pages long, you're going to be frustrated at me and at the assignment, and that's not what the assignment is intending to do, okay? So, is everybody following me on that? Do I want you to do good work? Yes. Do I want you to kill yourself on the outline? No. I'd much rather you be struggling and wrestling deeply with the exegetical more than the outline. Nevertheless, the outline I think is worth like 15% of your grade, so don't just blow it off, okay? Does that make sense? Everybody follow me on that? So if you are, you know, eight pages already in and you're only halfway through the book, you need to broaden your lens a bit, okay? Does that everybody make sense? It's due in like 2 weeks, so you got time. Okay? Okay. Okay. But what I want to show you is that Mark actually has put the things in the places he's put them for a reason. That there is an actual strategy of what he's doing here. And I would argue that what we find over the next two chapters revolves around the number eight. Now what I've listed here, what I am going to suggest are eight miracle accounts. Now what are one of the things that you notice right off the bat, if I'm calling these miracle accounts, what do you notice right off the bat that may be a bit strange or that somebody could object to? Say it again? Yeah, some people would say, how could you suggest that the callings of Peter, Andrew, James, and John in the calling of Levi, how can you suggest those are miracles? Those aren't miracles. Those are callings. Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, I'd give a literary answer to that objection. Literarily, these function as what? The first and the last function is what for the other six in between? Bookends. Right? And knowing that literary pattern, what is on the inside, it seasons what's on the outside and vice versa. They interact with each other in a way that gives, it's like what I was taught by Mark Scott and by Mark Moore and everybody, that it's the bread of the sandwich. And when you have a sandwich, what you have in the middle of the sandwich does season the bread and the bread vice versa. Therefore, I would suggest literarily to immediately dismiss these as miracles is really not to pay attention to the way in which they function, what they surround. Because I would say possibly what is happening on in between could be commentating on what's happening on the outside. Second thing I would argue is a theological answer. To suggest that the transformation of someone's life from a non-follower of Jesus into a follower of Jesus is not in some sense miraculous is simply to not understand gospel conversion. That's what I would say, theologically. We saw that what they had to... As a matter of fact, even the way in which this happened almost seemed miracle-like, didn't it? Jesus randomly walking beside the Sea of Galilee as it is portrayed in Mark. And what does he say? You, follow me. And they say, okay, and just walk away. And you're going, huh, something seems to be happening here that's bigger than what seems to be on the surface. That's why you have a lot of people pontificating about whether or not Jesus had interaction with Peter, Andrew, James, and John before that moment. Because it's such a... It's such a shocking moment whenever he just says one word and they drop everything and follow. It's almost miraculous in a sense in the way it's even portrayed. Sociologically, I would say, this is my third argument, sociologically, to suggest that somebody like a pagan or like a Jewish tax collector, which is really even worse than a pagan one, a Jewish tax collector, which is really caught between two worlds because he is a Jew and yet he is taxing his Jews for the Roman Empire. Sociologically, that person is murdered. And the only thing to restore that person back the dignity and into a community in which he is accepted, it's basically on the level of a resurrection. Because sociologically, he's dead. He's dead to the Jewish people. It's one of the reasons why they even asked Jesus, why in the world are you eating and drinking and hanging out with sinners and tax collectors? Same category. Because you don't associate with these losers. And yet Jesus says, actually, he's not only going to be a part of my community, he's going to be one of the key leaders. I would argue then, because of the literary structure, the theological analysis, as well as the sociological analysis, that these very easily can be seen as miracle accounts. It's just that we have to broaden our definition from a magic trick into something a little bit broader. So, in light of that, and you don't have to agree with that assessment, if you don't want to, that's fine. In light of that, though, I'm going to progress as if it is true. What would the significance of the number 8 be? Why 8 miracle accounts? Yes, new creation type theology. 7 is an important number in Jewish literature. Why? What does the number 7 symbolize? Revelationers? What's that? Completion. And it goes back to what chapter and even verse, if you want to get down to the technicality of it. What does it go back to in the Old Testament? Number 7. Creation. For how many days did it take for God to create the world? Technically 6, but he tacked on a 7th because God needs to rest. Really? God needs to rest? No, he doesn't need to rest. The Jews saw that as God getting up to the number 7, and all of creation then revolves around this number. For we have 7-day periods that once you hit day 7, you go automatically, the next day goes back into what? Day 1, you start it over again. The cycle of 7 never stops. However, Christians come along and they suggest that what Jesus did was so incredible that whenever he moved from the 7th day to the first day, he didn't actually start the cycle over, but he rewrote history. He began a new cycle. For Jesus didn't go from 7 to 1. He went from 7 and moved to the 8th day. You see the difference? He breaks the cycle of old creation, beginning a new creation. As a matter of fact, let me read to you Sibylline Oracles 1.324 through 329, because it connects Jesus clearly to the number 8 and what they feel like he's accomplishing with that number. Now notice the language. This is going to be cryptic language. This is going to parallel what we even see in Revelation 13. It says, 4 vowels and 2 consonants in him are twice announced. The whole sum I will name. For 8 ones and as many 10s as these, and yet 800 will reveal the name to men insatiate. And do thou discern in thine own understanding that the Christ is child of the immortal God Most High, and he shall fulfill God's law, not destroy, bearing his very image, and all things shall he teach. What are they trying to communicate? What's the point of Sibylline Oracles 1? What's the initial part, the weird thing that I read about the name? What? Well, technically what they're doing is they never name the name of Jesus, do they? But they say they're talking about the Christ, the one that will be dedicated to the Most High God, and then they cryptically reveal his name by suggesting a couple of things. Number one, they suggest that there are 4 vowels and 2 consonants, and in him are twice announced. Then it suggests that the sum will be 888. And that's whenever you take it out, and you lay out to the 4 vowels and the 2 consonants of Jesus, Jesus, and then you put it down into the numerical values, which I've got listed here, it equals 888. Why? Why are they trying to get 888 for Jesus' name? Because Jesus is the beginning of a new creation. That has kingdom implications, I think, right? Doesn't that whole concept of new creation have kingdom implications? Jesus comes and he says, I'm going to establish a kingdom, a brand new kingdom. that will not only challenge the kings of the world, but eventually it will supplant them. That's new creation talk. Therefore, my argument would be the reason why we have 8 miracle accounts right after the proclamation of Jesus establishing a new kingdom is because Mark is now showing what Jesus has already said. Jesus comes, and in Mark chapter 1, 14 through 15, he proclaims, "The time has come, the kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the euangelion." And Mark says, and then he begins. For verse 14, or for, technically it's 16, if you want to be accurate, begins this 8 miracle accounts. And he doesn't stop at 7, he moves us into new creation. See how this makes sense? Or are you totally confused? I have no idea what I'm talking about. 7 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Feedback. Maybe that'll be a help to gauge this. What are you thinking? Does something confuse you? Yes?
Would the readers recognize that?
Yeah, would they? Couple of things. Let me say this about this. Because that's a typical question, and it's not a bad question. It's a typical question a lot of times we ask whenever we see interesting literary insights. Think about how this book even came to be written. Number one, what was the request of the Roman Christians in order that eventually got this document written down? We want a what? No, think of John, Mark, and Peter. And then when Peter's preaching, the Roman Christians say, we want John Mark to write down what Peter has said for what purpose? So we can have a monument, a memory of Peter. Therefore, my argument would be, they probably wouldn't read this just once flippantly. That'd be my first argument. If it's a living monument of Peter and of what Peter was connected to, Jesus, it would be something I would suggest they would pore over. Number two, Jews are more attuned to seeing these literary patterns than what we are. We're very linear thinkers. We want to hear the facts, just give me the descriptions. You know, whether you're doing fiction or whether you're doing nonfiction, whatever, we're more linear. They look for what lies below the surface. That's just something they're attuned to. I mean, think of the different ways in which they interact with the Old Testament, the oral traditions, things of that nature. Their understanding of what lays behind the text is something that's much different than our own. Number three, they're going to look for Jesus even within Jesus at every point. Just look at the allegorical interpretation that came out in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. They look below the text to find Jesus. Therefore, something like this, whenever you have miracle account, miracle account, miracle account, miracle account, eventually they would stop and say, like I did, hold on, let's count these. Because, you see what I mean by that? All these different elements, I would say, do I have evidence that they pulled out all 8 of these? No. Would this have passed them by? No, not necessarily. Could they have caught it easily? Sure. Could Mark have easily put that in there on purpose? Absolutely. These aren't idiots. Just because they're 2,000 years ago doesn't mean they're morons. They appreciate literary structures and even theological implications just as much, if not more, than we do. Okay, so there is always a danger of finding something in the text that's just flat out not there. However, whenever you see Jesus goes into these 8, and then immediately it's interrupted once we get to chapter 3 with the Beelzebub controversy, which the Beelzebub controversy is consistently looking back to the miracles. Everything is pointing, both what comes before and what comes after, back to these 8 accounts. So eventually, they love counting things. They love counting things. You see the sibling oracles? They love counting things. Because they believe that the numbers had power, that there's symbolism in the weight of the numbers. Yes?
Do you have any other examples of like the 8, kind of like Matthew, and we know that they talk about 12 and 7 and 3, a lot of stuff like that. Do we have any other examples like the number 8 appearing throughout Scripture?
Sibling oracles, the number 8, and the number 8's really more of a Christian thing. 8th day creation was really big, really in like the 2nd and 3rd centuries. So 8th day creation would have been something that would have been more Christian than Jewish. But that's the point. If we are locked in the old creation is a locked in a 7-day cycle, and yet Jesus moves to a resurrection on a new day, Well, I mean, Second Corinthians 5 says, you, because of Jesus, you are a new creation. It's suggesting that he is bringing what was supposed to be reserved for the end of everything into space and time. Therefore, while we're living in creation, we are also living in a new creation. So while everybody is locked into a seven-day period, we literally are living in a perpetual eighth day. So there's the simultaneous new creation, old creation, until eventually the old creation gets swallowed up by new creation at the second coming. Yes. Yes, these are the eight consecutive miracle accounts that occur from Mark 1:14 through 2:17. Yes, they're right in a row. We just go, we're going to go bam, 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 miracle after miracle after miracle after miracle. And every miracle will have its own different nuance. But I'm pointing out the fact that there is eight is pointing to something bigger than just merely throwing out random historical accounts. Yes?
So even at creation, when God did 7 days, was God planning on the fall? And that's why he was planning on the eighth? Day, or how does that all work?
Yeah, I mean, I think we'd be reading too much into that. Do I think God was totally surprised by the fall? No, I don't. I don't think he's like, oh no, what am I going to do now? But I'm not. At the same time, I'm not going to go all the way and say God planned the fall. That's a little bit making a theological assumption that I'm not willing to do. So I'd be kind of in between of the open theist on this one and the Calvinist on the other extreme. Nevertheless, it's kind of like this. It's kind of like whenever we have a revelation, is it because God first thought it at that moment? Or is it because God just decided to give it to us at that moment? Or is it because God's always had it planned at every moment? Like, it's kind of a, yeah, maybe, maybe. All of them. You know? God's going to roll with the punches, but God's not surprised by any of them. But it doesn't mean he's dictating it. It doesn't mean he's not. I mean, I think we also have a danger of mitigating the sovereignty of God and suggesting that he's handcuffed from planning things that we don't like. You know what? I'm sorry. And this is where people, I mean, man, whenever I talk to people about the problem of evil and stuff like this, they just don't like me. And the reason why is because I just trust God more than they are willing to. Whenever I just flat out say, you know what? He's bigger than me. And do I understand or even like the genocide of the Old Testament? No. But he's bigger than me. And he gets to call shots, and he gets to change his mind. He can do whatever he wants. And I cannot like it, but it doesn't mean that my shots would put us in any better position than what I think they would. In other words, a lot of times people would say, well, isn't there a way of doing the Old Testament without the genocide? I think there should be. But it doesn't matter what I think. To suggest that if I wipe out all the genocides, that all of a sudden we're going to have a better world than what we have now, is to simply overstate what I can actually accomplish with my own finite thinking. I can't see the whole picture. I don't know what would be sacrificed if it was done different in the Old Testament. I don't know. As a result, I'm okay with trusting that God's bigger than me, that he is good, and that he's ultimately going to fulfill his purposes no matter what junk happens on down here. So, the questions of did God plan this? Did God do this? That means nothing to me. And I know that some people are like, oh, you're just dodging the answer. No, I just trust him. And that's what I've committed to. And you can call that foolish all day long. I'll just call it faith. I mean, it's, you know, whatever. Okay, other questions? Thoughts? Yeah.
I don't understand the whole eighth-day creation.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
It's like this. How many days do we have into a week? In a week? Seven. Five, six, seven. And then, once you get to day seven and you move to the next day, what do? You go back to one. And we're perpetually caught in this cycle of seven. And what characterizes the cycle of seven is sin and the fall. It's almost like we're locked in this seven-day cycle. But when Jesus come, and on the first day of the week, he resurrects. What the Christians eventually interpreted is that really wasn't the first day of the week in the sense that we've gone back to number one. It was actually that he broke us into a new existence, which would be best way of calling it an eighth day. In other words, what he did at the resurrection was so monumental that it shattered everything of the old creation. And it inaugurated a brand new creation that we can refer to theologically as an eighth day. But in our seven-day cycle, well, an eighth day doesn't make any sense. Neither does the resurrection. And that's the point. That's the point. What the resurrection was such an anomaly that it can't fit into what characterizes old creation. It has to be characterized by a new creation or an eighth day. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it's really the eighth day concept is pointing to the accomplishment of Jesus. A new creation is inaugurated that we will eventually fully experience at his second coming, although we can't experience some of it now. Yeah, Tom.
This is why Mary sees Jesus as a gardener.
Right? Elaborate.
I think this is right.
Yeah, I think you're right too. Go ahead.
John makes a point, I think he brings up like three times that the resurrection is on the first day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know anything about like the numbers, John's just ran through a series of seven, and now he's emphasizing the resurrection is on the first day of the week, first day of the week, first day of the week. And you have that weird moment in the Gospel of John when Mary sees Jesus, and John says that she thought he was the gardener.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, why does she think he was the gardener? Because she's in Eden.
Mm-hmm.
She's back at, you know, the first day.
Absolutely. Well, matter of fact, even whenever John, and you're exactly right, whenever John starts counting the signs, you know, the miracle in Cana is the first sign, and then he points the second one, then he never does again, which he's saying he's inviting you to count. And if you count, I argue that the seventh sign is the crucifixion. Therefore, the eighth sign in John would be the resurrection, new creation. See how that makes sense? Yeah, absolutely right. The reason why she mistakes him as a gardener, I think, is because he, more than, and that's where sometimes we're going, well, did she really think he was a gardener? That's not the right question. It doesn't matter to me if she thought he was a gardener or not. Could she? Absolutely. Does it matter? No. The point is, John is saying something is happening that's bigger than the actual historical event that you're obsessed with. If you just focused on now exactly what happened, did he heal Peter's mother-in-law? Did he call... If you're focused down here, then you never get to pull up here and actually see what's occurring. And the mentioning of the gardener saying, theologically, there's something bigger here that's happening. And that's why the Gospel of John ends in the garden and begins in creation. In the beginning was the Word. The Word was with God. The Word was God. In the beginning was the Word. See what he's doing? That's why Revelation ends in a garden. John's he's always looking at the big picture. Big picture. All right. If you have any more questions, you can talk to me later about that, but we want to keep moving. So that's what I think is happening here in these events. And we've already dealt with Simon's mother-in-law. And so we are in verse 32. That evening after sunset, what's significant about that? Not theologically, but just practically. After sunset. Why is he designating after sunset? Yes, that's when the new day started. So we are on the Sabbath. Sabbath would have begun Friday night at 6 p.m. and it would have ended Saturday night, 6 p.m. As a result, whenever the sun set on Saturday, which would be the Sabbath, they were allowed to move about. So that evening after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. They know Jesus is in town, but the stinking Sabbath is getting in the way. And they're like, come on, Sabbath end. And as soon as 6:01 comes, bam, they start taking their sick and their demon-possessed to Jesus. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons because he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. Notice again, this miracle account emphasizes what miracle in particular? Exorcisms. Why? What is theologically significant about exorcisms? What's that? Yes. Jesus says, I've come to establish a kingdom here. It's not just Rome and the Jewish kingdoms that are reigning in that region. It's also Satan's kingdom that's reigning in that region. Therefore, you see consistently at the Sea of Galilee, then right after that you see a demon possession, then you have the healing of Peter's mother, and then you have more demon possessions that are being healed again. Jesus is saying, I am establishing a kingdom, and that means I'm directly attacking the kingdom of Satan. Unabashedly. He is going after the kingdom of Satan, which will make the accusation in Mark chapter 3 of Jesus being possessed by Satan all the more humorous. Because all of his actions initially are pointing towards his opposition to the kingdom of Satan and not his collusion with it. You see the difference? So consistently, that is emphasizing that he's driving out demons as a means of saying, Satan, here I come. We also see the emergence of the messianic secret for the second time. Now, the first two times are attached to demons wanting to pronounce who Jesus was, which we talked about last time. That probably wouldn't be good on his resume to have demons saying, "Oh, we know who he is. I don't want you to tell people who I am." Therefore, he shuts them up for a second time. We're going to hit the third time here soon. It has nothing to do with demons, which makes the messianic secret all the more conflated. But we'll fully talk about that the last day of class. Not on the eighth day, but on the 200th day or whatever. Verse 35, very early in the morning. That phrase, very early in the morning, occurs five times in the Gospel of Mark. Now, where it occurs is significant to me. It occurs here in Mark 1:35. Jesus arises to pray during the healing scenes that I'm arguing is to symbolize the establishment of his kingdom. That's why there's eight. The second time it occurs is in Mark 11:20. What do you notice about that? Mark 11:20 is the second time the phrase very early in the morning occurs. What's significant about that? Anybody? Anybody? Not the actual account, but where it occurs in the book.
It's a lot later.
Yeah, not only is it a lot later, but that's whenever we've already gone through pretty much the whole Galilean ministry, and now we're in Jerusalem. The last four times the phrase is used is in the week of Jerusalem. Very early in the morning, Mark 11:20, Jesus cleanses the temple. Then very early in the morning, they walk by the fig tree that he cursed in 11:12 through 14. And now it's withered, which we will argue later symbolizes the establishment of his kingdom and the falling away or the cursing of the kingdom of Israel that had failed to produce fruit. Number three, Mark 13:35. After describing the unexpectedness with which Jesus will come back in the second coming, he warns his disciples to keep watch and to be prepared for he could come back at any moment, even refers to in that section about being very early in the morning. But what is the second coming also pointing to? The establishment of a kingdom. Number four, Mark 15, verse 1. After Jesus is arrested and Peter disowns Jesus, Jesus is taken very early in the morning to appear before Pilate. What's significant about that event? Because that will precipitate into the crucifixion, which is the establishment of his kingdom. The very last time this phrase occurs in the Gospel of Mark is Mark 16, verse 2. When the women go to the tomb very early in the morning. What do you notice about that phrase every time it appears? It's always in the context of Jesus establishing his kingdom. Always. Very early in the morning, he goes up and prays, and that lobs right in the middle of all of these miracle accounts that are culminating to be the establishment of his kingdom. Next time you see it, it happens to deal with the cursing of the fig tree, which is a symbolic way of establishing, or Jesus saying, my kingdom is established, yours is leaving. 13:35, the second coming, he's saying that has something to do with kingdom establishment. 15:1, when the crucifixion is about to occur, has something to do with the establishment of the kingdom, even though it doesn't look that way. And then obviously 16:2, when they go very early in the morning, what precipitates is the acknowledgement of the resurrection, which I hope you understand has something to do with the establishment of the kingdom. Is that, you see how that makes sense? Yes?
What was the second verse reference on?
Mark 11:20 is the second verse reference. So it's Mark 1:35, Mark 11:20, Mark 13:35, Mark 15:1, Mark 16:2. All right, moving on. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him, and when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you!" Okay, now here's another word we're going to trace throughout Mark. Just so that... we'll skip the devotional moment for now. Every time the word, look... looking for you appears in the Gospel of Mark, except for one. It is always negative. Mark 1:37, Peter comes looking for Jesus. Why is Peter looking for Jesus? What's his explanation? Everyone else is looking for you too. And why is Peter excited about that? Because maybe he found him. Why is he excited that other people are looking for Jesus? Because he's getting popular. And according to the Jewish perspective, if the Messiah's goal was to return the exiles back to their land, eventually you'd have to have some people following him, right? If one of the Messiah's goals is to destroy the enemies, you're going to need an army to do that, you'd think. At least that's what the Essenes thought that you needed. Therefore, the fact that Jesus is generating popularity in Peter's mind points to the fact that Jesus is being or becoming what he wants him to be. And that is the Messiah that's going to take back what rightfully belongs to Israel. So Peter's all excited. They're looking for you. But the very fact that Peter's looking for him in the Gospel of Mark shows that something negative is probably happening, except for one time. But it occurs, the exact word occurs 10 times. Mark 1:37, it occurs right here. Mark 3:32, the Beelzebub controversy, it says, Jesus' family came looking for him because he had gone mad, according to them. The third and the fourth time it is used is in Mark 8:11 and Mark 8:12. The Pharisees come to Jesus looking for a sign. And Jesus says, this corrupt and adulterous generation is always looking for a sign. Even though they've had quite a few signs before them already of what was happening. You see why he gets a little frustrated? The fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth time, it all refers to the same concept. Mark 11:18, Mark 12:12, Mark 14:1, Mark 14:11, Mark 14:55 all refers to times in which the Jewish elite look for a way to kill or arrest Jesus. And the very last time which redeems looking for Jesus is in Mark 16:6, whenever the women come to look for Jesus at the tomb. Do I want to do the conclusion? No. We'll just keep moving. So Peter comes looking for, hey, Jesus, everyone's looking for you. Hey, the Messiah, we can establish the kingdom through our violent coup. Woohoo! Verse 38, Jesus replied, let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I've come. But do you notice something that's happening there? You have Peter coming with his agenda saying, people are coming to looking for you. I'm going to even interrupt your prayer time, Jesus. People are coming to look for you, and that's what we want, because that's how we're going to overthrow the enemy. And Jesus says, let's leave those people and go over here. Why? Because I want to preach the gospel, the good news of the kingdom. That's why I've come. I've not come to gather a big group of people so that we can have a violent coup, Peter. I've come to go preach the news, especially to the least of these. Jesus, why would you go from where there's swaths of people in these cities to the little villages, the unwalled cities is the word that's used there for where Jesus wants to go. Because my kingdom is bigger than your political agenda, Peter. It's bigger than that. What you're looking for doesn't even make sense with what I'm trying to establish. So even though this makes sense in your agenda, it's actually antithetical to the one I'm trying to establish. So he traveled, verse 39, so he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and driving out demons. Consistently. I will say this really quick about prayer. A couple of things. Number one, if you don't pray a lot, it's probably because you're not as entrenched in the war as you should be. The war. If you don't pray a lot, it's probably because you're not as entrenched in the war as you should be. Because whenever you're on the front lines and you're fighting consistently, it's pretty amazing how often you're driven to your knees to pray. Actually, Mark Scott's father used to say that the key to a good prayer life is heavy burdens. That's appropriate. Because the more you're laboring with people, and the more that you're serving people, and the more you're laying yourself down for people, the more that you carry on other people's burdens, whether you like it or not. I don't know how many times in ministry I've been up all night praying, not because I'm holy and I just am like, you know what, tonight I'm just going to spend the night. Because I can't sleep. Because I know either someone else is hurting or someone else is being hurt by the church or something is occurring. Whenever you're on the front lines, it's amazing how much the burdens of the people that you're serving actually drive you to your knees. And a third reason why you probably don't pray very much is because you don't understand how powerful of a weapon it is in the war. Man. In the book called Bondage Breaker by Neil T. Anderson. It's a book about a counselor that deals with demonic exorcisms and things of that nature, in case you're wondering what it is. But after his group had successfully exorcised this guy that was a leader of a satanic cult, they eventually, down the road, they started asking him questions about the weapons of Christians that are the most that were the most impacting on him transitioning. And they said, as a leader of a satanic cult, what was the thing you feared the most about Christians? And it was interesting because the satanic leader said, the prayers. He said, we could always tell whenever Christians were praying and when they weren't. Because we were way more successful whenever they weren't praying. And he just flat out said, your number one weapon is prayers. But we treat prayers like the ABCs that we just flippantly throw out before we eat a meal. I would rather you not pray before meals and get a real prayer life than for you to pray before every single meal and not really understand what prayer is about. Does that make sense? I would much rather you have a better prayer life than just before your meals. And you know, we act like, though, that if you don't pray before your meal, then you're just not pious and holy as I am. I'm going, dude, I don't care how many meals you pray before, your 30-second prayer. I want to know you're laboring in prayer throughout the day or in your own closet. That's where the real war is being fought. Not before your, preservative-laden green beans. Like, yes, Jesus may have to do a miracle for that to be beneficial for your body. But I don't think your prayer is what's going to convert it. Does that make sense? Have a real prayer life. That's what Jesus is exemplifying for us there. Okay, let's keep going. So he traveled throughout Galilee, preaching in the synagogues and once again driving out demons. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees. Now this is interesting because we don't know exactly where he came to Jesus at. In the Gospel of Matthew, it says there were large crowds around Jesus after the Sermon on the Mount. And amidst those large crowds, this leper came to Jesus. Now, let's just act like that is the scenario for the moment. If there are large crowds around and the leper comes and bows down before Jesus, what's the problem? Oh, yeah. This leper has forgotten who he is. That's the problem. Because lepers are not supposed to be around people for two reasons. Number one, the practical physical reason. You could get other people sick. That's why there are leper colonies away from all the people, separated, because they believe that even the disease of leprosy can get into the walls and eventually jump back out and get the people. It's kind of a cootie concept. They kept them away. Physically, it was protecting the community for them to be ostracized. Ritually, it was as well. For a community could not be pure if there's something as impure as leprosy within the camp. Therefore, a leper was not only not supposed to come into the communities of the people, but anytime he did, he would have to do what? Scream unclean as loud as he could so that everybody could stay away from him. And yet this guy, in the Gospel of Matthew at least, comes right down in the middle of the crowd and starts bowing down to Jesus asking to be healed. That is not just seen as a desperate move. That's seen as a threat to the society. And they would expect the Messiah to handle it in a certain way. Because whenever the purity, matter of fact, even the Pharisees taught that the purity of the people, the impurity of the people, is what got them into the mess of the exile to begin with. That's not just the Pharisees talking there. That's the prophets. It's your impurity that led you into exile. And one of the driving reasons why the Pharisees were concerned of purity was so that the eschaton could actually begin. Because the purity of God's people would probably prompt God to move, to bring His exiles back into the Promised Land. And so when the Messiah comes and somebody does an act that's as reckless and as impure as this leper, you'd expect the Messiah to rebuke him. And that's not what we get at all. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." This will be the definition of faith that will consistently surface throughout the Gospel of Mark. Faith is defined in the Gospel of Mark as not just hoping really much that what you believe in is actually true. Faith is an acknowledgement in the identity of Jesus, the power of Jesus, and submitting yourself to it. That's faith. Now, there's mystery involved in that because you don't know all that He can do. And you know as well as I do that whenever you're suffering through this world, that sometimes those mysteries turn into doubts and those doubts turn into uneven ground. Nevertheless, in the Gospel of Mark, the definition of faith, which is something I think that we could benefit from, is the acknowledgement of Jesus, his identity, the acknowledgement of his power, and the submission to it. That's what you see here. He comes to him, bows down, forsaking all of the sociological taboos that he's breaking. He says, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Why? Because of who you are, because of your power, and I'm going to submit myself to that. Because without you, I'm going back to my sociologically dead life. Filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. Not smart, Jesus. That's breaking so many rules. Because ritually now you're unclean. And even physically, you're probably going to get the same disease. No real Messiah would do something that foolish. Jesus says, I am willing. Be clean. Immediately the leprosy left him and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. Actually, the word there is rebuke or reprimand. Sends him away with a strong warning. See that you don't tell anyone, or see that you don't tell this to anyone. Third time the messianic secret appears. Don't tell anyone. And Jesus gives us an explanation here of why he doesn't want this guy to say anything. But go, show yourself to the priest. Well, actually, no, I'm sorry. Verse 45 will tell us why Jesus didn't want him to say anything. Although I think there's a bigger issue at play here, which we'll talk about the last day. But go, show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them. What Jesus is doing here is this. There are two reasons why he sends him away and tells him to do the right Jewish thing that's told to a leper in Leviticus 14. He says, you go there because this will reintegrate you into society. This will allow you to be a part of the community once again. See, because if you're a leper, it's not just that you have to be a part of this community over here, away from the bigger community. As a leper, you have lost your family, your wife, your job, your dignity, your honor. You are absolutely ostracized for the protection of ritual and for the physical protection of the community. And when Jesus says, go, offer sacrifices to Moses, he's saying, go integrate yourself back into the society. For this is not just a physical healing that is happening here with the leper. It's a sociological one. Where Jesus is saying, not only, it's an economic healing. Not only will you be allowed to be a part of the community, but you will once again reaccumulate your family and your livelihood and your dignity. You will be, once again, ritually pure. Something that this guy may not have experienced for quite some time. See, the restoration of physical healings always is something bigger. It's not just Jesus going around and going, I'm an awesome magician, zap, 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 zap. You're healed. Walk, my friend. These people were perpetually in a state of shame. And Jesus not only physically heals them, but that has sociological implications of what they're allowed to be and do now. He gives this guy literally his life back. This is almost on the level as a resurrection, sociologically speaking. And Jesus says, I want you to go reintegrate yourself back into the community, and your reintegration back into the community will be a testimony to them that something big is happening. A kingdom is being established. But I don't want you to tell anyone about me. Just go be a witness to the kingdom being established. Verse 45, instead, this stinking leper went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. Evangelism as disobedience. Write a paper on it. Because that's what happens here. Jesus commands him not to evangelize, and he says, sorry, can't help it. I've got to. And he does. As a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. You see one of the reasons why Jesus says messianic secret's important? He says, if it gets out, I'm not even going to be able to go to the least of these, because I'll be surrounded by... I won't be allowed inside of the towns. I will, in a sense, this is kind of interesting. You know how it talks about in the cross where Jesus takes our place, takes his sins upon us, the death that's belonging to us, he takes? In a sense, the leper and Jesus switch places here. For the leper was the one out in the lonely places away from all the towns. He wasn't allowed in because he was ritually unclean. Once Jesus heals the leper, Jesus now takes that on himself, and he is the one that's outside of the towns and communities. Something that's both beautiful and frustrating all at the same time. Yet, the people still came to him from everywhere. It didn't matter where he was, they were going to find him. A few days later, when Jesus again entered Capernaum, so notice, he was in Galilee. He was in Galilee throughout all of this, the Galilean towns. Now he's coming back into Capernaum, which is significant because Capernaum is what for Jesus' ministry? The home base. This is where it's all based from, the base of operations in Capernaum. The people heard that he had come home. Where did he go in Capernaum? Where did he go? Where is home for Jesus in Capernaum? We have seen Jesus in one home in Capernaum in the Gospel of Mark so far. What home was that? Peter's home. Peter's mother-in-law's home, at least. Peter's family's home. More than likely, that home is the base of operations of Jesus. Peter was, allowing Jesus to be his tenant. which is pretty significant because of what happens in just a moment. Whenever they dig a hole in the roof of the home, Peter's like, daggone, following Jesus does cost a lot. Okay, but we'll talk about that more tomorrow. I love you guys. See you then.